After 10 days of a work slowdown, Fairbanks area septic pumpers are back to work. The pumpers formed a committee to alleviate aggravating problems, crap, to work with Municipal Utility System Manager Harold Gillum, Sewage Plant Manager Jim O'Neill, and the City Council to resolve grievances stemming from an ordinance requiring the pumpers to pay what they considered an unfair rate for dumping septage into the sewage treatment facility. It's not that the pumpers didn't want to pump septic tanks, according to spokesman Bud Hilton, but they worried about collecting a higher pumping fee they would need to pass on to their customers. And most of the companies were answering emergency calls. As Hilton said,
after all, you know what? You just can't let people go to pot. We're obligated to the people that we do business with.
This morning, Hilton said he was looking forward to going back to work, as were the other area pumpers. But MUS manager Gillum wasn't particularly enthusiastic. His problems have been compounded by a strike, still going on, of the sewage plant workers. Administrative staff were busy keeping the septage flowing until other personnel could be hired, and that hasn't happened yet. And in addition, no one is picking up garbage or snowplowing the streets. And in order to get the septic tank pumpers back to work, the City Council has temporarily suspended all septage fees for people not hooked up to the city sewer system until a new ordinance with new rates can be established. Gillum said that would be done soon. And meanwhile, the MUS loses money. But at least the homes and businesses that need their septic systems pumped will be able to get some relief.
Somewhere out there tonight, someone's pipes won't work just right. Now, probably they will not freeze, but suffer a more bizarre disease, because even though it's warm and sunny, Gunther pipes are nothing funny. Call Bud Hilton. He'll get on the go, and soon your pipes will flow and flow. Because with his slogan, have hose will travel, your plumbing mysteries, Bud, will unravel. Call Bud Hilton.
Way down.
Carrie McPherson in Fairbanks. Ruth Stratton of Fairbanks is Mrs. Alaska, 1979.
Hands that are strong but wrinkled, doing work that never gets done. Hair that's lost some of its beauty by too many hours in the sun. Eyes that show some disappointment, and there's been quite a lot in my life. She's the foundation I lean on, my woman, my woman, my wife.
It's kind of a conglomeration of being a contemporary woman, being married, be involved in your community, whether it's, you know, politically or being involved with organizations, charitable organizations. It's just being involved.
The contest judging, however, is based on poison personality, an evening gown competition, and a swimsuit competition. How does that reflect community involvement?
Well, 40% of the judging, 40 out of 100 points, is on the judge's interview. And the kind of questions, I can speak only from my experience, but the kind of questions that they asked me had to do with state politics. They had to do with community involvement on a level such as charitable organizations. They had to do with national political things, how I felt about the national political situation. How I felt about the people who are organizing and running our country, about world leaders.
Do you feel if you'd come out with a statement that the country needs to be overthrown, I want to put every dope smoker on the streets, I want Dizzy Gillespie as president, and I think everyone should go barefoot at 40 below, that you would have been considered acceptable?
I think it would have probably made a definite impression on the judges, and I don't think it would have been good.
So do you think that certain points of view are more acceptable than others?
I think so. You have to remember how important it is, if you're an ambassador for this state on any level, that you project the views of the majority of the people, or you project an image that is what the people would like to have them seen as.
So did you kind of practice to get into what you thought was the proper image for that?
No.
You just had it.
I was very unaware of having anything.
Ruth Stratton's image the day she came in for our interview could be described as the inside pages of Ladies' Home Journal rather than the cover of Cosmopolitan. The outside temperature was around zero, and she wore high-heeled boots, a plaid skirt, blouse, vest, and jacket, gold nugget rings on her fingers, and a gold pin on her lapel with the initials RS, and lots of makeup, but not the silvery evening kind. Everything reflected a kind of natural control. That control, called poise, got her through the February 10th, 1979 pageant. You obviously felt very strongly about the poise, the knowledge, the representation of the state. How about parading around in a swimsuit?
Well, I had reservations about that. And it wasn't until I went to the national pageant that I had a little bit better understanding of it. And helping this year organize the 1980 pageant, we have really discussed whether we as the state of Alaska need that part of the competition. Maybe it would be better to have sportswear, have someone, have the women who compete model in evening gowns and sportswear. But when she goes to the national competition, she will be expected to compete in a bathing suit. And there are a lot of reasons for that. An attractive woman in a bathing suit, when that picture is put out across the press, is much more likely to be picked up and published than one of a woman in attractive sportswear.
Though the notion of beauty pageants at all outrages some people, Stratton feels that the Mrs. America pageant has changed to reflect the times. Until 10 years ago, after all, a contestant for Mrs. America was judged on very different criteria.
Things like baking cakes, decorating cakes, fixing meals, ironing shirts, being able to pack a suitcase, being a very domestic woman.
And so the pageant faded to reemerge 4 years ago under new rules. But times are still changing, and the concept not only of so-called beauty contests, but of having a Miss or Mrs. competition rather than Ms. could be considered anachronistic as well. Mrs. Alaska 1979 had no response to that, but she pointed out the different image of an Alaskan woman compared with women in other states.
I feel maybe this cheesecake version is a lot less here than maybe in some of the other states where they are truly pageant orientated. And I found a difference in the women that those states had represent them then, and I had different ideals about the pageant than a lot of women that I competed with nationally.
What did motivate you to do it? I mean, just in general, did somebody rope you down, get you drunk, sign your name on the dotted line, and now you're in the contest?
No. I like being involved in my community, and it seemed like so many of the major events that take place in this state take place in Anchorage. A lot of the major events do. And this was a major event, a statewide event, taking place here in Fairbanks. And these sort of things come about because people in the community want to be involved, want to project Fairbanks or Anchorage or whatever town a little bit. And if people don't become involved and don't participate, then those things die or move to another community. And that was my first motivation. And the second motivation was, I think a lot of Alaska. And to be a selected representative seemed like a remarkable honor to me. Not that I had any intentions of winning when I started to participate. I thought it would be a good growing experience. It would be something I've never done, which I had never been homecoming queen or involved in any pageants or any competitions of that nature in my entire life. And it was also kind of nice, I thought, to have a pageant that didn't exclude if you are married.
Contestants must be at least 18, a resident of Alaska for a minimum of 6 months, a U.S. citizen, married, and living with their husband.
Being married and living with your husband is an important factor.
Why?
Well, I don't know that you can truly be a Mrs. if you are not living with your husband? I mean, he might be on the North Slope or might be doing something like that, but I mean, if you're keeping two separate households out of choice, that would probably not be the kind of image to project a Mrs.
How does your husband feel toward all of this?
Oh, he's very proud of me, and he's enjoyed it.
Is it like saying, I'm the husband of Mrs. Alaska?
Well,
I'm Mr. Alaska?
They've sort of teased him about that, because when they did the promotionals, or when they did the news release after the pageant this year, there was a competition going on for Mr. Alaska, which happens to be a bodybuilding competition. And they happened to show the news releases of my being selected as Mrs. Alaska, and this very attractive fellow with a lot of muscles just right afterwards being selected Mr. Alaska, which caused us a lot of laughter.
Ruth Stratton reported that when she won the Mrs. Alaska title, her kids just wanted to know if the diamonds in the crown were real. They weren't. And unlike the Miss America contest, there was no Mrs. Alaska song, but that may be remedied soon.
We should definitely try to put to get a song that would just be for the pageant.
What angle would it take? Any idea?
I don't know. I think maybe something a little more original than just the Alaska flag song, but maybe something along those lines.
80 stars of gold on a field of blue, Alaska's flag.
Women interested in entering the Mrs. Alaska contest may contact the pageant office at 514 2nd Avenue, Suite 102, Fairbanks, Alaska, 99701. With thanks to Les Stuck, I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Every year, approximately 40,000 books are published in the United States, exclusive of the government. One of the titles that will be coming out either late this year or early next year is A Dictionary of Goddesses and Witches, published by A.P. Dutton and written by Fairbanks writer and teacher Pat Monahan.
Why a dictionary? And why a dictionary of goddesses and heroines?
Well, a dictionary has the advantage of being easy to organize. It's A and B and C and D. I got interested in the myths that, I think the first book I checked out of the library was Bullfinch's Mythology. I just love mythology. But in reading for many years in mythology, I found that the women figures was always organized the gods, the heroes, and then the goddesses. And the goddesses were always very briefly noted, and usually in terms of who they were allegedly married to. And in societies which didn't have marriage, I think it's very amusing to construe mm-hmm. of gods as, you know, officially married and monogamous when they were very rarely monogamous. So I got interested a few years ago in just sort of collecting information on these very strange figures. I don't know where to start giving you examples. They're just such great ones. Lilith is a Jewish demoness and goddess, and she goes into babies' bedrooms, and she likes to steal them. So she'll tickle their feet, and then when they start to giggle in their sleep, she strangles them. And in Jewish tradition, if you hear your child giggling at night, you're to rush in and tap it three times on the nose and say, "Away, Lilith, away." Lilith also was Adam's first wife, who left him because she refused to lie under him, thought that being equals, they should lie side by side, and cavorted off to the desert to have orgies with demons, according to the slander that's come down through the centuries. She's a very interesting figure. We don't hear much about her. In our culture, we've got, you know, Eve and Mary, and, you know, Eve's the one that was responsible for all the problems that we face. Adam would certainly never have sinned if it weren't for Eve. Therefore, extrapolation, women are you know, basically bad and trying to lead the world into bad things.
So do you see this dictionary as kind of correcting the record in a way of mm-hmm. offering another perspective on
the possibilities, the female possibilities that are cataloged in the mythologies of the world are amazing. I find that in doing the writing itself, there our biases are very much in our language. Mm-hmm. You know, crone and hag, those are very unpleasant words, and yet the reality that the myths express is strong and positive.
The woman warrior, the Amazon, the strong woman, is just beginning to be reestablished as an image of femininity, according to Monahan.
many cultures have had this as something to be worshipped. The woman who strives for physical
woman.
Right for physical prowess, Brito Martis in Greece, all of the beautiful goddesses who ran around in the woods with beasts and lived by themselves, and you know that they're I think particularly worshipful in Alaska. You know,
sounds like you have an affinity toward these goddesses that ran around with the beasts.
Well, I used to live out in the woods, and I sort of think I'm. Currently, I'm thinking of myself as Flittish, the Irish goddess of the beasts.
Monahan isn't expecting women to use the book to find new names for themselves, although she has been assigning goddesses' names to friends when she finds something appropriate. But she does intend, as a feminist, that the book will help women to explore, as she puts it, the possibilities of female reality. It will be a different sort of reference book than Webster's in other ways as well. For one thing, it'll have larger type, and it will be illustrated with examples of ancient art.
Mm-hmm. Photographs of the Aphrodite of Ephesus and some of the great, particularly statues and artworks of the ancient world that portray these realities.
The snake goddess of Crete.
The snake goddess of Crete, one of my favorites. I think these visual images help you see the power and beauty of the figures where sometimes the words might not, again, because of the limitations of our language, might not be able to say it as well. So it will be sort of a picture book as well as a list of stories. I'm writing most of the entries as stories rather than as dictionary entries. I think that'll make it more easy to assimilate and more interesting to read. This is a story told of Ninhursag, one of the Babylonian goddesses. Long ago, in a fine fair town, the serpent goddess of birth and rebirth lived with the god of wisdom. Where Ninhursag and Enki made their home in Dilmun, there was no age or death, no sickness, no barrenness, not even the animals harmed one another. One day, Ninhursag's belly swelled up. 9 days later, the goddess Ninsar, or Ninmu, was born. The lascivious Enki seduced his daughter, who bore Ninkura. Then Enki slept with his granddaughter, who bore Utu, the goddess of plants. Of course, Enki wished to sleep with his great-granddaughter, but Ninhursag whispered to her that first she must demand a bride price of cucumbers, apples, and grapes. The lusty Enki granted them, and Utu agreed to occupy his bed. From their affair sprang 8 different kinds of plants, living things the world had never seen before. But Enki ate his offsprings as quickly as they appeared, before the mountain mother Ninhursag could even name them. Furious with the greedy god, Ninhursag leveled a curse at him so terrible that he immediately fell down, stricken in 8 parts of his body with 8 different diseases. The other gods grew concerned as Enki weakened and grew thin. But the great goddess, still angry at the god, refused to heal him. Finally, when Enki was, it seemed, a breathing corpse, the congregation of heaven prevailed on Ninhursag to cure him. Still unwilling to heal him so that he could resume his upsetting behavior, the goddess agreed to a compromise. She would not heal him directly, but would create 8 tiny goddesses to control the health of Enki's afflicted parts, and they could do the healing if they chose. And indeed, the little goddesses set to work, and soon Enki was well again. Some say, however, that Ninhursag finally did cure Enki herself, and that she did so by placing him within her vagina once he could be reborn whole.
The Babylonian Story of Ninhursag, one of the entries from A Dictionary of Goddesses and Witches, a work in progress by Fairbanks author Pat Monahan. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. At a work session last Friday afternoon, the Fairbanks City Council arrived at an interim solution for Fairbanks septic tank pumpers who protested the high price of dumping sewage into the city's sewage treatment plant. An ordinance effective January 1st raised the rate from $1,800 per truck per year to $181 per 1,000 gallons, a price local pumpers said was way too high, and so they refused to pump, leaving residents and businesses who needed their septic tanks pumped out of luck. Friday's meeting saw some compromise between the city and the Committee on Resolution of Aggravating Problems, that is, CRAP, the 6 local pumping companies. The rate for dumping sewage was temporarily lowered to $2.24 per 1,000 gallons of septic, the same rate paid by residents hooked into the city sewer system. But that compromise failed to satisfy all of the pumpers. As of this morning, one company still refused to pump until there was a permanent solution to the rate problem, and another was attending emergencies only. The Committee on the Resolution of Aggravating Problems contends that with the pre-Friday rate, collecting fees for pumping would be difficult, since the average charge for a homeowner would go up from an average of $60 to between $200 and $300. In a telephone conversation on Friday, Harold Gillum, general manager of the Municipal Utility System, admitted that the $181 rate was high, but stated that he felt a fee of between $100 and $125 was defendable. But Bud Hilton, owner of one of the affected companies and spokesperson for CRAP, said that rate
wouldn't be considered.
Hilton doesn't think much of the interim city rate either.
I think the rate set for the people of the city is perhaps double of what it should be, maybe even a little more. They have not had a realistic evaluation of this whole picture at all. The whole thing should just flat be thrown out and get somebody in there that knows how to figure.
So you don't see going back into the regular pumping business for a while, then?
Well, yeah, I'd sure like to be. You don't think that it's only the love of the materials we handle that we're in business. It's for the sake of sanitation. And it just tears me up inside to see these people have troubles.
Uh-huh. If it were to go back to the former rate of $1,800 per truck per year, would you go back to pumping?
Oh, definitely. Very definitely, yes.
And so for now, people with septic systems needing pumping will have to wait until the city council can resolve the problems between dumping rates and pumper owners like Bud Hilton and the members of CRAP. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
We are under colonial administration that we have no control over. We're going to want our rights as Americans, and we're going to feel that those rights are being trampled upon. If we can't get our rights as Americans, maybe we should go our own way.
So says Barry Jackson, attorney, former legislator, and current member of the Alaskans for Independence. Speaking before a meeting of the Farthest North Press Club in Fairbanks last Friday, Jackson predicted separation could happen when 65% of Alaskans of all persuasions agree on the need. And just how would that occur?
I can't tell you the precise mechanics, but it would happen.
Although independence is usually achieved through revolution, is that what Jackson envisioned? No, not revolution, but...
by mutual consent.
And the alternatives?
It's a long pipeline. The Arab oil embargo and the effect that had in the lower 48 is nothing compared to what would happen if we shut down the pipeline. Now, you remember that the world is getting so interdependent and the systems are getting so complex that it is very easy to create major damage. Alaska would have the means of creating far more damage than the country would be willing to stand. I'm not threatening that. I'm just saying when the time comes that we suggest to the lower 48 that it is in their interest to let us go peacefully and by mutual consent, the alternatives to their consenting to it may be worse.
Although he pointed out that the bulk of the pipeline is above ground, Jackson claimed he had nonviolent action in mind, though he acknowledged that some Alaskans might resort to violence, possibly against each other, and a civil war situation would be far from desirable. As he stated, he doesn't want to see a Northern Ireland in Alaska. And what does he see for the nation of Alaska?
My own view is that we'd be a member of NATO, and that we would probably have American forces on bases up here, that I'd like to see us go into the Swiss system, in which all Swiss males, I wouldn't limit it to males though, between 18 and 45, have a weapon and have a mobilization station and a unit that they join. I think if we had that, we could probably put 80,000 men and women in the field in 6 hours.
Defense concerns aside, Barry Jackson doesn't envision provinces or states would like a democratic republic, and he's also interested in getting back into politics himself. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.